Chapter 27. Jan Polus stood beside his pony. The mist had dewed in his beard and set it to sparkle in red gold. Across both shoulders, heavy bandoliers of ammunition drooped, and the Mauser rifle seemed like a child's toy in his huge hairy hands. His jaw was thrust forward in thought as he reviewed his dispositions. All night he had flogged his pony from lager to lager. All night he had roared and bullied and driven men up the slopes of Spionkop. And now around him the mountain rustled and murmured with 5,000 waiting burghers, and in an arc of 120 degrees behind it stood his guns. From Greenhill in the northwest to the reverse slopes of the Twin Peaks in the east, his gunners crouched beside their Crusoes and their Nordenfelts, ready to range in upon the crest of Spionkop. "All things are ready, and now I must earn the right to wear this hat." He grinned and settled the Homburg more firmly over his ears. "Enny, take my horse back to the lager." The boy led it away, and he started up the last slope towards the summit. The light strengthened as he climbed, and the burghers among the rocks recognized the flaming beacon of his beard.
"Goeiach, oom Paul, and kom saam om die Roynekker te skiet," they called.
The two burghers ran down to meet him.
"Oom Paul, we have just been forward to Allo Knoll. There are no English on it."
"Are you sure?"
It seemed too generous a gift of fortune.
"Ja, man, they're all on the back of the mountain. We heard them digging and talking there."
"What commando are you?"
Jan Polus demanded of the men massed around him in the mist.
"The Carolina commando," voices answered.
"Come," ordered Jan Polus. "Come, all of you. We are going to Allo Knoll."
They followed, skirting the summit, with the brush, brush, brush of hundreds of feet through the grass, hurrying so that their breathing steamed in the moist air. Until, abruptly ahead of them, humped the dark mound of Allo Knoll, and they swarmed over it and disappeared among the rocks and crevices like a column of ants returning to their nest. Lying on his belly, Jan Polus lit his pipe and tamped down on the glowing tobacco with a fire-calloused thumb, sucked the smoke into his mouth and peered into the solid white curtain of mist. In the eerie silence that had fallen upon the mountain, his stomach rumbled loudly, and he remembered that he had not eaten since the previous noon. There was a stick of biltong in his coat pocket.
"A lion hunts best on an empty stomach," he thought, and drew again on his pipe.
"Here comes the wind,"
a voice whispered near him, and he heard the rising sibilance of it through the aloes above his head. The aloes stood tall as a man, multi-headed, green candelabra tipped in crimson and gold, nodding slightly in the morning wind.
"Yeah," Jan Polus felt it stirring deep in his chest, that blend of fear and exhilaration that drowned his fatigue. "Here it comes."
He knocked out his pipe, stuffed it still hot into his pocket, and lifted his rifle from the rock in front of him. Dramatically, as though unveiling a monument, the wind stripped the mists away. Beneath a sky of cobalt blue, soft golden brown in the early sunshine, lay the rounded peak of Spionkop, a long, uneven scar of red earth, 500 yards long, was slashed across it.
"Almachtig," Jan Polus gasped. "Now we have them."
Above the crude parapet of the trench, like birds on a fence rail, so close that he could see the chin straps and the button on each crown, the light khaki helmets contrasted clearly with the darker earth and grass. While beyond the trench, completely exposed from boots to helmet, standing in the open or moving leisurely forward with ammunition and water canteens, were hundreds of English soldiers. For long seconds the silence persisted, as though the burghers who stared over their rifles at this unbelievable target could not bring themselves to press the triggers on which their fingers rested. The English were just too close, too vulnerable. A universal reluctance held the Mausers silent.
"Shoot!" roared Jan Polus. "Skit, Carol, skit!"
And his voice carried to the English behind the trenches. He saw all movement among them suddenly paralysed. White faces turned to stare in his direction, and he sighted carefully into the chest of one of them. The rifle jumped against his shoulder, and the man went down into the grass. That single shot broke the spell. Gunfire crackled in hysterical unison,
and the frieze of khaki figures along the trench exploded into violent movement as the bullets thudded amongst them. At that range, most of Jan Polis's burghers could be trusted to knock down four running Springbok with five shots. In the few seconds that it took the English to dive into the trench, at least 50 of them went down dead or wounded and lay sprawled against the red earth. Now there were only the helmets and heads above the parapet to shoot at, and these were never still. They ducked and weaved and wobbled as Woodgate's men fired and reloaded, and 1,700 Lee Metford rifles added their voices to the pandemonium. Then the first shell, lobbed from a field gun on the reverse slope of Conical Hill, shrieked over the heads of the burghers and burst in a leap of smoke and red dust 50 feet in front of the English trench. A lull while Jan Polis's heliograph team below the crest signalled the range correction to the battery. Then the next shell burst beyond the trench. Another lull, and the third fell full upon the trench. A human body was thrown high, legs and arms spinning like the spokes of a wagon wheel. When the dust cleared, there was a gap in the parapet and half a dozen men frantically trying to plug it with loose rock. Together, all the Boer guns opened. The constant shriek of big shells was punctuated by the vicious whine of the quick-firing pom-poms. And once again, a mist covered the peak. This time, a thin, sluggish mist of dust and lyddite fume, which diluted the sunlight and clogged the nostrils and eyes and mouths of men for whom a long, long day had begun.